Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
In the sauna, the men are sitting in the middle shelf, instead of the top, as they usually do. Karloff throws a dipper of water on the rocks and sits back down in the steam. Latos, sitting between Karloff and Otto, is slicing through the steam with his hands, as though measuring and chopping the steam into 2-inch sections. Karloff and Otto say nothing about his odd conducting movements, figuring the movement as well as the steam are getting the alcohol out of his system. "Do you know anyone whose life isn't a tragedy?" Latos asks as he continues to conduct and slice the air, expecting no answer. Otto and Karloff know enough not to answer. Otto gets up to get the switches of birch and hands a few to Latos and Carlos, keeping some for himself, then throws another half-dipper on the rocks. "Personal tragedy," Latos says, flicking the birch branches against his thigh. "Millions of them," he adds, reaching above his shoulder to flick the birch twigs against his back. For the next 5 minutes, the men switch themselves lightly with the birch switches, casually, yet as if the sauna is swarming with flies. Gradually, they slow down their switching, and they're sitting motionless as three red and rosy naked Buddhas with their ceremonial birch wands and big northern feet, silently meditating in the steam, transformed by the fire and water of the sauna, their spirits at peace, and most of Latos's alcohol and despair evaporated and having risen up the chimney. By the time they've rolled themselves in the evening's light snow and dressed, all three are recharged, and Latos' faith in the all-purpose power of the sauna is confirmed. They have reversed the order of dinner tonight in order to eat after the sauna instead of before. So when the men come inside, the women have already placed two small wooden tables together, cozily in front of the fireplace, set chairs on one side, and pulled a bench to the fireside. The table is covered with a deep blue cloth with frayed edges and a rather too large arrangement of dried flowers and dusty pheasant feathers is set in the center. The men sit down on the bench in unison and immediately get up again and push the bench aside and pull up more comfortable chairs. Tilly sets the creative casserole with raisins on the table. Fawn has brought freshly made Italian focaccia, baked with extra virgin olive oil and herbs this afternoon, in which she knows everyone but Greta will eat with ketchup. And Otto's homemade blood sausage, which has been in the warming oven for the past half hour with the now slightly crusty hot dish. Millie has set out a glass of ice water for each person and put extra glasses, root beer, and cream soda, but no beer, at the end of the table. Fawn tucked a bottle of Chianti she bought in Thunder Bay back into her old canvas Literary Guild tote bag, unopened. Greta has asked Fawn not to mention Dr. Winkle being in town because she doesn't want anyone to know she saw a psychiatrist when she was in Thunder Bay. But Fawn says she can just say she met him at the artist cooperative where he bought the stained glass work, and they needn't mention the office visit at all. Greta heads to the kitchen for pepper. It's still snowing, and even from inside, she can tell it's those amazing huge flakes that are so noticeably perfect. Individual. She thinks of herself and her friends as flakes of snow, unique like that, floating through the night. Gabriel used to say our lives were so infinitesimally brief, if we consider eternity, that a life really goes by in the wink of an eye. Greta returns to the table, determined to enjoy a piece of Fawn's Italian bread and some of the twins' macaroni and cheese. As long as she doesn't look at the red-black blood sausage, she won't lose her appetite. And Mabel came late and missed the sauna, but brought a raspberry pie which looks exquisite. As they begin the meal, It's apparent that Latos is pretty much back to normal. Tells everybody about the trip down the lake to see Jim Nightman, and they're all pleased that Shadow has a good new home and yet may have the option of going wild. They can't hear enough about spirit animals. Everyone is fascinated by the story of the white deer and the possibility that Shadow might be a spirit animal. Karloff says he wouldn't be at all surprised if he wasn't a spirit animal. Being half dog and half wolf, and with those two different color eyes, you couldn't really look at him. Karloff's opinion is that he could go either way. He could be tame or wild, or tame half the time and wild the other half. I think maybe I was darn lucky he stayed with me, even if it wasn't for long, Karloff says. A spirit dog would leave some kind of magic behind wherever he goes, I would imagine. And Karloff feels a real sense of luckiness, so much so that he can see the hair on his wrist stand up, as if there is too much static electricity around him. Everyone has a tale to tell about Shadow, or some incident with a dog they've known, and with all the spirit animal talk, everyone seems to have forgotten the howling that was getting on everyone's nerves, until Mabel reminds them as she cuts the pie. "I hope he don't come back," she says, passing everyone a large wedge of pie topped with vanilla ice cream. "He scared me." They start eating silently. The pie is heavenly, and they know it deserves their full attention. Latos doesn't want anyone to go home thinking about Shadow, so he tells them about Jim Nightman's wife, Sarah Blue, and what a talented artisan she is, and how she makes beautiful beaded clothing and bags and moccasins, but won't sell any of her work. Greta and Fawn look at each other, feel they know where Greta's Christmas moccasins came from. Greta asks if Jim Nightman has long hair, and is puzzled when Leto says no, it's real short and prematurely gray. Leto shrugs his shoulders, thinks he shouldn't have brought up Sarah Blue and her bead work after all. Now they'll be thinking about the break-in when they were down in Thunder Bay. He doesn't know who that was. Could have been anyone, as long as they had long black hair. Latos goes to the jukebox, plays the Tennessee Waltz, glad the evening is over, and he kept the dancer from Mars to himself. The air outside is icy. No wolves or dogs are howling, and the pickup truck doors slam shut one after another, following hasty goodbyes. Fawn and Greta are the last to leave and ride together in Greta's reliable old Volvo. There is nothing left of their silly frivolity of earlier in the evening, brought about by the telephone message Dr. Winkle left on Greta's answering machine, which they both listened to. "Greta? Dr. Winkle here. Willie, to you, of course. Well, I made it. Call me when you get back. I'm at Daryl Farrelson's Bed and Breakfast. Not quite what I expected, no, but I'm sure it'll be a worthwhile experience. Most interesting town. And Daryl has a lot of fine leather crafting tools here and a remarkable calendar collection." They slow down for the eyes in the ditch, two does. Fawn invites Greta to stop in for Chianti and stay over if she wants, and she eagerly accepts, being none too keen about going home, now that she's thinking about the long black hairs on the quilt in December, and she doesn't want to find another message from Dr. Winkle on her answering machine, or him parked in her driveway. She can call him tomorrow in time to arrange a lunch at the coffee shop, and then she assumes he'll be leaving. Another pair of eyes shine out from the edge of the road, either a small fox or Frosie's cat. It darts into the woods as they pass by, and Fawn is relieved to reach her drive without seeing any more eyes. From Fawn's back porch, she points out the moose prints next to the hay bale she keeps over her rose bushes. "Like living in a zoo," she says as she opens the door, and they hear the far-off cry of a wolf as they step inside. At Apollo Bay, Gabriel's eyes have adjusted to the dark inside the purple fishing tent. He watches the pale orange bits of bait float slowly to the bottom of the bay, where he's dropped the oatmeal. Occasionally, he sees a flash of tiny fish flutter past the ice hole, but it's their enemies, the big pike and walleye, that he's waiting for. The spear is heavy, so he doesn't actually have to do much. All he has to do is wait, then drop the spear when a fish comes into view. He likes that the weight of the spear will kill the fish, making him less involved than if he had to use a good deal of force to hurl the spear. But he knows spearing is luck, either his or the fish's. And the larger fish are smart, which is why they are large. Timing is the critical part. He has to drop the spear at precisely the right moment, slightly ahead of the fish as it moves within range. Its winter sluggishness will be to his advantage, yet it will lurch ahead as soon as it senses danger. A sleek gray blimp of a fish glides into view and pauses momentarily. Gabriel jerks the spear over the hole, and the fish is gone. He moved too fast. He decides to hold the spear directly over the hole, then all he'll need to do is let go. He drops more salmon eggs into the water and a few pieces of marshmallow laced with rice to make them sink, just a foot or two. He positions the spear with the tips just under the surface of the water. He's ready, particularly now that his stomach is grumbling. He's alert. The spear gets heavier as the minutes pass by. He keeps his eyes on the hole and hardly lets himself blink. When he's almost ready for a break to rest his arm, a large dark walleye swims into view, snaps at the bait, and hovers directly below the ice hole, gobbling up the soggy bits of marshmallow. Gabriel drops the spear. A hit. The spear and the fish drop toward the bottom of the bay. As he hauls the spear up by the rope, he feels a leaden movement, something passing between he and the fish, like a deep, unpleasant ache, similar to a deadened tooth being pulled out of its socket. Gabriel lifts the spear out of the water, and the walleye writhes, trying to free itself, but is held fast by the primitive fork, a prong deep in its head and mid-back. The pike's mouth gapes open at the horror of its own death. Blood, fish slime, the intricate pattern of silvery scales. Gabriel shudders as he pulls the fish off the spear, lets it slide into the pail near the tent's door. He swishes the blood off the spear in the icy water. The fish makes a last feeble slap against the bottom of the pail as Gabriel walks outside into the bright winter morning. Coming out of the tent, he stumbles and nearly drops the fish when he sees a wolf standing a mere 20 yards from him. His first thought is to get his fishing knife out of its sheath. He hesitates. Is it a wolf? It's big and long-legged. A dog? The creature wags his tail at Gabriel, makes a bowing gesture to show he means no harm, that he's friendly. Gabriel relaxes and calls out to the wolf dog. Here, boy. The wolfish dog trots over and continues wagging his tail as Gabriel ruffles his fur. Gabriel laughs out loud. He adores this dog that looks like a wolf. In his eyes, such wonderful expressive eyes, one yellow-brown and one blue. An odd dog, yet he has great dignity. He sits beside Gabriel as he cleans the fish and eats a small portion of the innards Gabriel tosses him, but appears to do so more out of politeness than hunger. He follows Gabriel about as he assembles his cooking equipment, gathers twigs and pine cones to use as kindling for the fire. Gabriel wonders if the dog watched this morning while he cut a fallen birch tree into logs, or if he was nearby while he did his morning exercise routine, as best he could, in bulky winter clothing, using a fallen tree as a bar. It was pleasant doing his exercises in such an expansive vista, where he could look at the blue sky and the dense forest instead of the mirrors and walls of a studio, and he ended up shedding his outer jacket as the sun rose in the sky. Now, with no wind, the fire starts easily as soon as the flames reach the papery birch bark, and Gabriel sits down on the stump he's pulled up near the fire, feels quite efficient as he fries his fish. He allows himself to forget its unpleasant end on the spear. The wolf dog sits comfortably nearby, as though they have sat watching fish fry many times together over the years, and Gabriel's gray socks and red wool blanket airing out over a tree branch behind them add a touch of domesticity to their campsite. There was a Cafe Apollo somewhere in Greece, along the coast, though he can't quite recall where, known for their culinary greens, salads with mud-colored olives, nestled in spinach leaves like displaced body organs, bright, juicy tomatoes the color of this tent, and pale Swedish anchovies. He remembers the delicate endive and bib lettuce, the deep emerald green herbs and spinach green so remote from this white place as to seem mythical. And the soup was a rich lemon yellow, laced with pine nuts and rice. But this is better. This walleye that was swimming leisurely about below the ice 15 minutes ago, now flaky and tender on Gabriel's fork. Definitely the freshest, most delicious fish in the world, he's certain, as he squeezes more lemon juice on his salt and peppered fillet. With his morning coffee and a slice of hearty rye, he wants nothing more. He tosses the dog a crust of his bread and decides to call the wolf dog Shadow because of how quietly he appeared and how he follows him about so closely and attentively, as though he is Gabriel's guardian. He is happy having the dog around for just the day or for the rest of his life. Chapter 15. There are no icicles on Greta's garage this morning. She'll have to look on the sunny side of Don's grocery store before she returns to the lake. Greta drives doggedly down the road to meet Dr. Winkle at the coffee shop for brunch. She wants to get this over with. She'll be polite, yet firm. She doesn't want to encourage him, doesn't want him to come back to Red Otter. Just be polite and firm, like Fawn said. Yet she's anything but firm this morning, at least physically. She's trembling, though just a little. From the night, the odd night, how many times did she wake, thinking Gabriel was calling her? She thought he was calling from the next room. But each time she awoke, she was in Fawn's guest bedroom, and it was quiet. No one was calling anyone, and it happened over and over, maybe 12 times, maybe 100 times. She would wake and listen, hear nothing, realize where she was, and look at the frosty windows glowing from the almost full moon, then sink back into a deep sleep in the warm, fluffy feather bed. The scene kept replaying itself over and over until morning, when she finally woke to a rosy dawn, felt so sweet and peaceful as though she had just been kissed, even though she had been through this long night of interruptions. Greta's morning drink is tea, and Fawn's strong coffee has given Greta the jitters. She should have taken the toast with honey, Fawn offered. Now she'll probably eat too much at the coffee shop and talk too much. She always does when she's nervous. Concentrate, she tells herself. Gives herself orders for the morning. Eat just a little. Don't talk too much. Be polite, yet firm. That must be his car, a yellow Karmann Ghia with black and white fake fur seat covers. At least she hopes they're fake. Are they supposed to resemble a Dalmatian? Holstein cows? And what is he doing with a Karmann Ghia in Canada? Amazing he even made it up here. There's a Mental Floss bumper sticker on the back of his car and an International Peace Garden sticker on the side window nearest Greta, which she reads as she pulls in. She was there once, on the border between Canada and North Dakota. Beautiful formal gardens that flow over gently sloping hills. She had her picture taken beside a huge garden in the shape of a butterfly, fashioned entirely of yellow and white flowers. That's something they can talk about. She makes a point of looking in his car as she walks toward the coffee shop and is surprised to find the interior so clutter-free. No papers, no empty pop cans, no old jackets or hats, clean as a whistle. Dr. Winkle is facing the door and sees Greta as soon as she comes through the coffee shop door. She says hi and waves, and he slides out of the booth, stands, and bows, much like an opera singer taking a curtain call or a magician ready to pull a rabbit out of his sleeve. The only other customer is Otto, who raises an eyebrow as he looks up over his Sunday Winnipeg sun and whom Greta greets with a nod. She tries not to think about the town grapevine as she sits down across from Dr. Winkle. Yes, Willie says and smiles as he leads toward Greta, then taps the metal pot between them. Hot water. I took the liberty of ordering it for our tea. He takes two tea bags out of his pocket and proceeds to pour steaming hot water into two white mugs. "Raspberry, our favorite," he says and smiles again. "And you'll find a little surprise in the bottom of your cup when you're finished." He laughs a very measured, quiet laugh and pushes Greta's cup in front of her. So what will she find in the bottom of her cup? A penny? The tea leaves laced with LSD? A rabbit turd? An opal? She drinks it. It's delicious. Gwendolyn brings menus, and Greta orders orange juice and a blueberry muffin, which she knows are homemade, quite large and delicious. Dr. Winkle orders French toast and grapefruit juice, and, as she expected, he does smell of Daryl plus stale cigar, which actually helps somewhat. She finds Daryl's smell to be a combination of just plain uncleanliness, much like a goat, plus a hint of leather and moldy rutabagas. She wasn't sure if Dr. Winkle would smell or not, though she thought he probably would. She walked through a friend's snazzy new dairy barn once before going to see a play, and simply walking through the barn without touching a thing left the cow barn smell on her clothes, her hair, her skin. All evening she could smell the barn, even though the dairy had glistened with new stainless steel pipes and glass tubing. It had been a cold fall day, and the barn was warm with the sweet smell of cows, which she didn't really mind. It was the barn smell she didn't like. "Dr. Winkle, I hope you don't mind if I call you Dr. Winkle. I'm more comfortable with that. Is that your yellow car out front with the, is it Holstein pattern seat covers?" "Yes, yes, you know your cows. Very good." Greta's muffin arrives still warm, and she sees the outline of the Big Dipper and the blueberries on its sugary brown top. Dr. Winkle empties the syrup container over his pancakes, thoroughly drowning Gwendolyn's lovely buttermilk pancakes, which disgusts Greta unreasonably, and she tries not to grimace. He says nothing as he forks soggy pancake pieces into his mouth, looking at Greta all the while with the bulging eyes of an adoring snake. She starts talking. "Start talking, Greta. Do something," she tells herself. She peels the paper from her muffin and tells him she hasn't done the stained glass work he wanted, the rabbits, that she isn't able to work on commission and simply has to do whatever comes to her. He stops eating and looks crestfallen. "Oh," he says, as syrup drips from his fork. She tells him he's welcome to one of her recent pieces, that she has done a window for her friend Fawn's outhouse and is nearly finished with two other small windows, one round and one square. He looks happy again, and his head moves in a delicate sideways motion, then slightly forward as he sops up another pancake. The cobra movements of his head and neck, along with the combination of the dirty Daryl smell and the sweet maple syrup, is making Greta queasy. She holds her teacup firmly and explains how the outhouses are emergency backup measures because of the occasional frozen pipes. "I have no problem with outhouses, no problem whatsoever with bodily functions," he says, "and there's no rush with the stained glass, no reason to hurry. I may be here for weeks. I've nearly convinced Daryl to take me on as an apprentice in the art of leather decoration. Daryl's going to sleep on it. Let me know in the morning. I think an art would be good for me, and he really does have the nicest tools, but I do have an ulterior motive, and that is helping Daryl with his problem, his hygiene problem. It may be he has a water problem. It may be he has a soap problem. Extreme fear of the unknown, you see. Most extreme. I plan to start with one foot. I'll have him soak the right foot in, oh, say, a pail of warm, soapy water. Not hot water, no, no, just warm water. Pleasant, you see. Then when he discovers he can survive soap and water on the right foot, we may have him on the road to recovery. The right foot is the key to success. Did you know that?" Greta shakes her head. "No. But, of course, I won't reveal my plan to him now. It jeopardized my chance of getting the apprenticeship, which I'm very keen on getting." Dr. Winkle runs his forefinger around the remaining puddle on his plate. then smiles at Greta with a sweet finger in his mouth. Greta wonders why the obscene is so fascinating, so repulsive. She pokes tentatively at the deep red bits at the bottom of her teacup. Perhaps some type of dried fruit? Yes, delicious tangy dried cherries, softened and warmed by the raspberry leaf tea. And she thinks it appropriate now that he bowed like a magician when she came into the shop. A visit with Dr. Winkle is like visiting a little walking magic shop with surprising treats and horrors. You never know what or which you'll get. When Gwendolyn takes away their plates, Dr. Winkle hands Greta an attractive package wrapped in a tasteful, dull gold paper. She opens the present cautiously. Two volumes of poetry, the top one verse by Robert Browning, and the other poetry of Mallarmé in French. One for Sunday and one for Saturday, he says, pleased with his gift. Next time I'll bring you some coal, he laughs, and he leans so far forward, Greta fears his sleeves are on his plate. He's so pleased with every second of this brunch with Greta, with his association with her and with himself. Greta tries to remember what she was going to tell him, says she must get back to the lake, that she's afraid she's not a very sociable person and has work to finish, and she'll leave a stained glass window for him. He can pick it up at Don's grocery on Monday or Tuesday. He raises his eyebrows and tells her one's sociability can be increased, and asks if she'll join him for dinner here at the coffee shop tomorrow night. She tells him no, but agrees to meet him here next Sunday for brunch again, if he's still in town. I'll be here, just you wait and see, he says, as he helps her slip into her coat. Things change with Willie in town. You'll see. As Greta drives away, she doesn't know how hard she's been clutching the steering wheel, until her fingers start to tingle and her knuckles have turned pale. By the time she turns into her driveway, she's decided to drive down to Winnipeg for a few days. She tells herself she's not afraid, she's not running away, that she just needs a change of scene. She's forgotten the icicles, she's forgotten to look for them on the roof of Don's grocery, and it will be the first day she's missed all month.
You've been listening to episode 10 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband, Robert Ellis, on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Today we will close with Snow by Peter Sculthorpe.